Welcome to Women in Translation, an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more. In this episode, host Joe Williams speaks with Slovak author and translator Ivana Dobrakovova. Joe began by asking her how she came to be living as a Slovak expat in Turin.
Okay, so it's quite a simple story. When I was 21, I met my future husband. And as soon as I finished university, I went to join him in Turin. But actually, I have always had this idea in my head that one day I would go away from Slovakia. In my childhood, my father, he was a mathematician, a professor. So he taught at universities all over the world, in the United States, in Venezuela, in Australia. And I remember just going through the photos and thinking of where am I going to go? And then I was always interested in languages. I enjoyed very much learning languages. So I studied translation and interpreting, and all the students during the summer wanted to go abroad, to France, to England. I actually didn't want to go to Italy. I wanted to go to France, but then didn't work out. But yeah, then when I met my future husband, it was like, I act before I think. So I didn't think about what it would be like to leave my home. And it took me like 13 years to get accustomed to living in Italy and to feel at home here.
I live abroad too. I've moved around a lot. I'm from England, but I live in Portugal at the moment. Wow. Via Korea and Vietnam and Mexico and one or two other places. And I wanted to ask you about your own personality or your identity, and if that has in any way fluctuated or changed or evolved since leaving your home country and relocating abroad, and how has your relationship with your home country changed as a result of all this? Do you still feel Slovak, or do you feel Italian, or is there some tension or conflict?
Okay, when you talk about countries like Slovakia and Italy, they are very different, and the people are different, the mentality, the national character difference. I always say to myself that I was lucky not to end up in Naples, where it would be much worse, because Piemonte and Turin are considered for the Italian standards as more reserved, and the people are more like not so open, but they are still very much more warm and open and cordial than the Slovaks. I have to say that me personally, I'm quite, well, you can say shy, but you can say also sociophobic. So I had a bit difficulty to adapting to the character of Italians, and it took, as I said, it took me quite a long time. And but I started to appreciate a lot of things. And when I come to Slovakia, I'm like, why the people are just so angry all the time and so not nice to each other. But I feel at home in Turin, but I'm not Italian, and I'm not considered as Italian by the Italians. But I grew to like the country and the people. So when my mom, for example, comes here and she's like, why are you talking to people? And I say, well, I know them, so I talk to them, because I live in this neighborhood called Vankilia, which is very lively, and there are lots of students, and we all know each other. So it's a bit like in a village in Slovakia when you greet everyone. And I don't like it when people talk bad about Italians, because, okay, so they're Italians. Yeah, they're different.
Sure. Yeah, I can identify with some of that, being English and then living in countries which have a more hyper-social, collective kind of way of living together, in which you're expected to always socialize and always be with other people.
Yeah, that's one thing that Italians love to do, everything in groups. And I sometimes need to be alone, which has become quite difficult in this corona crisis, because we are all working at home. So I was used to translating at home alone. Now there's my husband who has got conferences, and it's quite difficult sometimes. And even during the weekend, I'm like, okay, so I'm alone. And no, we are going to do a picnic, and and we are going there. And then my daughter, she wants to be all the time with her friends. And okay, so let's do it. But I sometimes, hey, I need to be alone.
Yes, I know how that is. Okay, at this point, maybe it would be nice if we could hear something, a reading of some of your work. And I understand that you've prepared something for us bilingually with a brief excerpt in original Slovak, followed by the corresponding English translation. So could you please introduce this for us and set this up for us, please?
Okay, I decided, I don't know whether it was a good decision, but I decided to read from my short story or novella called Veronica, which is in the book Mothers and Truckers that will be published this year in the translation of Julia Sherwood and Peter Sherwood in the publishing house Jantar. And Veronica is a short story that takes place in Slovakia. It's at the beginning of the first years of the millennium when the social media were just starting and the chat rooms, they're the times of internet cafes. And it's about a very young girl who goes to a French chat because she wants to improve her French. But actually, she gradually loses. It happens what usually happens to girls in chat. The men are just take her for a prey and she loses her inhibitions and she just accepts everything that they want from her. Okay, so first I read a short long paragraph from in Slovak. So, Veronika. To slovo sa neustále vracalo. Veronika aj rozmýšľala, že si zmení prezývku, ale už sa jej nechcelo nanovo prihlasovať, zadávať adresu, mail, vek, pohlavie, preklikávať sa všeobecnými podmienkami a zásadami využívania údajov. Preto to nechala tak. Veronik ostala Veronik. Zaumienila si však, že pri prvej príležitosti vyzistí, spýta sa, keď s tým ešte niekto príde a netrvalo ani 5 minút, aký si Christophe, exit moi Veronik, chynik, áno, prezradil sloveso Nike, znamená jebať a všetky Veronik, Dominik a iné Nik majú proste smolu. Dokonca bola aj taká reklama Le Veroniki Nik se pa automatik AAII do žartov. Veď Kristof sa na Veronik nepripojil preto, aby si spolu spravili lingvistické okienko, ale niečo úplne iné. Takže teraz poďme na vec, milá Veronik, čo máš takú výstižnú prezývku. No Veronik sa okúňa, Veronik nevie ako na vec, preto ju Kristof vedie jej ruky po klávesnici, po tele, to by teda radšej po tele, no počítač je v obývačke, matka práve pozerá správy, preto len po klávesnici. Veronik sa učí nové slovička suce a vale, sodomize, tašad muje. Veronik je to smiešné, Veronik sa kroti, nevybuchuje do smiechu, lebo veď matka, vážno situácie, niekto tam v televízii krádne, klame, zabíja, striela, umiera a privádza na svet petorčata. Zatiaľ, čo Veronik poslušne v tichosti napreduje v lekcii, cvičenie číslo 1, zmente vety podľa príkladu. Sus moi, je te sus, lež moi, je te lež, ça te plaît, ça me plaît, ah oui, Veronik sa to páči. Now in English, Veronika. The word kept cropping up so often that Veronik started wondering if she should change her nickname, but the thought of having to re-register, re-enter her address, email, age, gender, plow through all the general conditions and data protection stuff was just too much, so she gave up. Veronik remained Veronik, but she decided to find out, to take the first opportunity the next time it came up. And there it was, just 5 minutes later, someone called Kristof, excite-moi Veronik Nik. He let the cat out of the bag. The verb nike means to fuck. Tough luck, anyone called Veronique, Dominique and any other Nick has it coming. There was even this ad, Le Veronique qui nique, c'est pas automatique, ii, but joking aside, Christophe isn't interested in a discussion about linguistics. He's after something different. Let's get it on, dear Veronique, since you've picked such a fitting nickname. But Veronique is bashful. Veronique doesn't know how to get it on. Christophe has to guide her. She lets him guide her hands on the keyboard, on her body. The body would be preferable, but the computer is in the living room. Her mother is around, watching the news, so they stick to the keyboard. Veronique is learning new vocab. Sucé, avaler, sodomiser, tachat muyer. Veronique finds it funny, but Veronique controls herself, doesn't burst out laughing because mother, the gravity of the situation, someone on the TV is stealing, lying, killing, shooting, dying, giving birth to quintuplets. Meanwhile, Veronique is being a good girl, quietly making progress with her lesson. Exercise number one, change these sentences according to this example. Suce-moi, je te suce. Lèche-moi, je te lèche. Ça te plaît? Ça me plaît. Ah oui, Veronique likes that. Rico, the trucker, has a big red truck. Veronique is impressed. She finds red trucks incredibly sexy, much sexier than green or blue or gray ones. Veronique pictures a pristine truck, free of the dust of motorways, roads, petrol stations, just a clean red truck, without any horrible texts or images of a cow licking a happy farmer, a busty blonde offering biscuits, no adverts, nothing, just a taut, blood-red canvas, 30 tons of cargo, and Rico the romantic at the wheel. His name is David. Her new friend David is from Nancy. Veronique dashes over to take a quick look at the map. Where on earth is that? She knows nothing about Nancy, but she knows quite a lot about David by now. For example, he keeps using all kinds of smileys. Now he winks at Veronique, then he sticks his tongue out, then he rolls his eyes in amazement. David is serious. David didn't open their first chat by asking for a blowjob. It doesn't even come up later on. David just chats with Veronique in a normal way. School, girlfriend, parties. Veronique also tells him about her school, her friend Svetlana, her mother. Their chats are a bit tedious, but after a few days, he teaches her to make smiley faces. She remembers only two, a happy one and a sad one. Veronique forgets all the others, but Veronique is all right with that. Two emoticons will do for her. She's not demanding. David sends her his picture. Veronique notes that David is good-looking, un beau garçon. David sends her five happy emoticons in return. David is pleased that Veronique likes him even though he has a girlfriend. He loves his girlfriend, of course he does. But I have to tell you, Veronique, when I was young, I used to be a fatty. I was sweaty and smelly. The other kids laughed at me, a sad face. Veronique commiserates. She sends him a sad face too, followed immediately by a happy one, because David is good looking now. He's no longer fat. He even has a girlfriend, as he said. David also sends a smiley, two smileys, but he sticks to serious subjects. While at secondary school, when he went up the stairs, the other students would push and mock him because he would huff and puff. He struggled to climb the stairs. They were really mean to him, shouted at him. That's why he lacks self-confidence to this day. Veronique doesn't know what to say, so she sends three sad smileys and tells him she's sorry. Désolé, mon pauvre petit David. David nods and adds that he's very shy, but at the same time, he's happy to have found such a wonderful friend in Veronique. And Veronique is also happy to have found a wonderful friend in David, an orgy of smileys. How about a photo? Will you send me a photo? Do you have a photo? Come on, send me a pic. Hey, so where's that photo? I'll send you a picture if you send me yours. What do you actually look like? I want your picture. Momo is in love with her. Momo's full name is Mohamed. He keeps saying how much he loves her, truly, madly, insanely. Momo lives somewhere in Kabylia, in the desert, infertile soil, red hot sun, of course. Momo is cooped up all day long in a tiny mixed goods store, sweating and writing poems, which he sends Veronique with a dedication. Momo raves about her beauty in his poems. He compares her to a shining star in the sky. He lives in the desert, so the sky must look very different from what she sees on Šoltosova Street in Bratislava. Momo sings the praises of her soft, velvety skin. Momo is in rapture about her blue eyes. Momo wishes he could run his fingers through her silky, wavy, chestnut brown hair. Every now and then, Momo hints that it's about time that Veronique sent him her picture, as he longs to set eyes on the light of his days. But also, Veronique suspects his imagination may have its limits. Veronique finds Momo a bit boring. She's bored by his poems as well. One evening, she reads one of them out to her mother to boast that she's found someone who sends her love poems, but they lost something in translation. Veronique's hands trembled as she held a sheet of paper. Veronique broke out in a sweat, realizing how embarrassing this was. Her mother just chuckled. I bet he's copied them from some book that Arab is just sweet-talking you. Veronique knows her mother is right, but nevertheless, Veronique imagines Momo sitting at the till all day long, writing and rewriting his love poems, crossing out stanzas and dreaming of her heavenly beauty. Saib is a bodybuilder, or at least the picture he sent shows a bodybuilder. Veronique isn't sure. She took a good look at his huge biceps. No, this sort of thing really doesn't turn her on. Saib, on the other hand, is turned on all the time, or at least wants to be turned on. Mon bébé, excite-moi, bébé, tu me tailles une pipe, bébé aval. Veronique consents. Veronique always says yes at first. She kneels down in front of him. Yes, she gives him a blowjob. Yes, she's loving it. But as soon as she tries to change the conversation, like, what have you been up to today, Saib? Where do you actually come from? Saib logs off without saying goodbye, unceremoniously. He just logs off, only to log back on a few days later with the same or a very similar request. Oh, mon bébé, je veux lécher ta chatte. And Veronique replies on autopilot. Without giving it much thought, she tells him what he wants to hear, while Momo waxes lyrical about her neck and David sends sad and happy faces.
Thank you. So that's coming out later this year, as you mentioned, in English translation.
Yeah.
By Julia and Peter Sherwood, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. So thank you for your reading. And interesting that excerpt, because that is from Mothers and Truckers. And yeah. Mothers and Truckers actually won the EUPL prize, yeah. I believe, didn't it?
Yeah,
congratulations. Right. We'll look forward to seeing the English translation later this year. And could you explain a little bit more about the book, Mothers and Truckers? Is it a collection of short stories? Is there any kind of themes that kind of hold it all together?
Yes. Yeah, so it's a collection of novellas, five novellas, because they're, apart from the first short story, they're all longer, and they're all kind of loosely interlinked, but we hear always inner monologue of character, and they are all linked by their great fragility, but they are all in different situations and have different views on different topics and ideas. And the thing I wanted was to show in the inner monologues all the thoughts that could pass through their heads, even the most unacceptable, and how they may seem, because I think everyone has all kinds of unacceptable thoughts all the time. And the first novella is called Father, and there is this girl who recalls her childhood and the eccentric father that suffered from a psychiatric illness and all the excesses she had to witness. And so then there is Ivana, the second novella, which is a woman of 30 years old, but she has a mother, a very dominant mother, controlling mother, and she lives like she were still a teen, and she meets a journalist, and she kind of starts to recall her childhood growing in the 90s in Slovakia. There was this violent Wild West capitalism after the fall of the communism, and she recalls the circumstances that led to her breakdown when she was young and to her present situation. Then there are two novellas with the characters that are Italians, two Italian 39-year-old women, Lara and Olivia, and the stories take place one afternoon when both of them are preparing for their evenings out. And the first one, Lara, she's recalling her, she's thinking about her life and her divorce with her husband and loneliness, and she's inhibited, I don't know. And that was Olivia. And Lara, she can't complain being alone because she has two kids and a husband and three animals, but she kind of out of her mind in a different way. And then there is this Veronica, which is a 20-year-old girl who just loses all control on a French chat, as you have seen. And there is an open, but probably a quite dramatic ending. Okay.
Thank you. Yes, we'll very much look forward to seeing that later this year in translation. And on the subject of translation, you're also a translator yourself of Elena Ferrante, no less, and we will get into that shortly. But before we do, I wanted to ask you about your experience of the translation process as an author, mm-hmm. and perhaps your relationship with your translators, with Julia and Peter. So what's your understanding of the relationship between an author and a translator? Do you have a close working relationship when you're being translated as an author?
So yes, I know the situation from both points of view. As an author, I know I'm not easy to translate, everyone says me. But with Julia, I was very lucky that she chose me, because she translated already my novel Bellevue before the European Union Prize for Literature, and she's also very active. So I've been already twice in England presenting the book, and she's just great. We collaborate a bit. It's her work, but she asked me questions because sometimes I go too quickly and something is not too, there can be more interpretation. And it's mostly her that translates, and she consults it then with her husband. And she always sends me the text to read it before she sends it to the publisher. And I'm just feel so lucky. And even the translation of Bellevue, it was picked by World Literature Today as 75 most notable translations. So I'm really in English, no complaints. Then, but as for the other translators, sometimes we have a good relation. I have also a very good translator from Hungarian, Norbert Gyert, and from Italian, Alessandra Mura. But actually, I have already made enemies with some of them, because there was this girl who she kind of wanted to change the text because she didn't understand why I did something. And I said, no, you're not at home in my text. You must accept what I wrote. It's not like I would write differently. The role of the translator is not to improve the text. And there was another translator that I said nevermore, because he put 100 footnotes in my book. And I know that footnotes always kill the book, because nobody wants to read them. So I was like, no, okay, I prefer not to have a book translated than this. So I'm not always so nice with the translators. But, and there, for example, I have one translator, she's still working, and she just sends me pages and pages of questions. And I'm like, okay, I will tell you. But me as a translator, the first thing is not to ask the author, but to try to find out. There are things that you can find on the internet. If it's the linguistics, you can ask someone, but you shouldn't write 10 pages of questions every month. It's, you know, I would never permit that. I would never do that to authors. So.
Sure. Yeah. It can be quite a contentious, quite a tense relationship. Sure.
Yeah.
And I agree with what you're saying about the footnotes in a narrative text. They can really get in the way and interrupt the flow of the narrative and be really quite detrimental to the whole thing. It reminds me actually of, I was reading a book called Pedro Paramo from Mexico, mm-hmm. by a sort of canonical Mexican author called Juan Rulfo. Mm-hmm. And he's famous for writing this very highly colloquial and idiomatic, very culture-bound Spanish from mm-hmm. Guadalajara, I think. I had like the critical edition of the novel. The novel itself is probably less than 100 pages, but with the footnotes, it was about 200 pages. Sometimes like the footnotes were longer than a page was like more footnotes.
Okay.
And it was ridiculous. It was talking about the etymology of certain words when you're trying mm-hmm. to read the story. And yes. I was like, this is ridiculous. Yeah, so I'm very broadly on the anti footnotes in literary texts, when they can be avoided at least anyway. Yeah. And moving on to your work as a translator, and we've talked about your experience of translation as an author. Mm-hmm. But as we mentioned before, you're also a translator of literature in your own right from Italian into Slovak. And perhaps most interestingly and most significantly of Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan trilogy, Neapolitan novels. So we can talk about a lot of things here, but first of all, how did you come into contact with Elena Ferrante and her work? What did you first, what first informed your first interaction with her?
Yes, so when I came to Italy, the first thing I did was to buy all the translations that have already been made of Italian literature to get to know it a bit. I read it in the Slovak and Czech translations because I didn't speak Italian as well. And there was this book, Anthology of Italian Writing, and there was an excerpt of The Days of Abandonment, which was a novel before the Neapolitan novels. And this just stood out as the most intense, the best text of them all. And I was like, who is this person? And then when I learned better Italian, I bought all her books and I just love The Days of Abandonment and I don't know what was in English The Daughter, The Lost Daughter, and all the other novels. Then I started reading the Neapolitan novels that were coming one in a year, and at the time I met my publisher from INAC. She was just small publishing house starting, and we met in Bratislava and we were in a cafe and we were talking about Elena Ferrante, and she said, oh, I love it, and I saw the movie of Days of Abandonment, and I was then for translating a novel by Antoine Laurent from French, and then she said, okay, so let's try Elena Ferrante, and I said, okay, so which novel, hoping for the short note. I said, no, let's start with the Neapolitan novels. And at the time, I didn't even know how many volumes there would be because they didn't say so at the beginning. And I was like, oh God, I can't even read before what I will have to translate. But I spent 3 years translating it, and they were like very beautiful years of my life because I really love translating in Elena Ferrante, and I really enjoyed it. I remember that I always read what I will translate the next day, and I forgot myself, and I discovered that I'm reading it again and more than I should, and it was really fine. Very happy that I had this opportunity to translate her.
And what's your working relationship with her? Do you have a good working relationship, close or?
Okay, my problem is that when I translate an author, I always want to be friends with them. I don't tell them, oh, I'm also a writer or stuff like that, but I tend to be too personal. So my publisher said to me, okay, I know you love her, but don't write too many love letters to Elena Ferrante. She's important for us. So actually, what she writes is quite clear. I don't have difficulty understanding the text. So I remember that I wrote to her after the first book, I wrote to her this love letter where I expressed my feelings to her books. And I also wrote how I resolved one problem that was because she talks about Borsa Nera, which is the black market. And it in Italian, it means also the black bag. And this little girls, Lila and Elena, they think when they hear about Borsa Nera that the adults are talking about some bag, and then only later they discover they're talking about the black market. So I explained this how I resolved, but I didn't write to Elena Ferrante because she's already so requested by everyone. If I don't have really a problem, as I said, I prefer to ask. I live in Italy. If I don't understand something, I can always ask the Italians. But she replied to me, and it was a short letter, very nice, and it could have been written by anyone in the publishing. I hope it was Elena Ferrante. Yeah.
Wow. Great. You touched on something quite interesting there, some of the challenges that arise from translation. And was it Bolsonaro? Bolsonaro, the black bag, the black market.
Bolsonaro, sì.
Bolsonaro. Okay, so obviously you've got a double meaning there, a kind of wordplay ambiguity, which is the kind of thing which can pose a challenge, a difficulty in translating. So I wanted to ask you about this problem, about specific problems of translating Italian into Slovak. Are there any common, consistent problems that you encounter to do with linguistics, with the structure of the language, with the grammar, with the syntax, or more culture-bound with translating concepts or objects which are not familiar to Slovak readers? What are the most interesting challenges you've had translating Italian to Slovak, or Elena Ferrant in particular? Mm-hmm.
Okay, my main problem in translating is that Italians talk too much and they say things that the Slovaks wouldn't say. They say obvious things. When I translate them, it's okay, so why is he saying it? For example, they have this expression, eccoci qua, here we are, you're here. You wouldn't say it in Slovak. And so sometimes just to make it not sound awkward, you must put there some phrase, but you have to work it out somehow to what would sound natural in Slovak. But with Elena Ferrant, I didn't have particular problems, I must say. I translated, I don't know, 2,000 pages of Elena Ferrante, so sometimes I feel like a medium, just the translation passes through me. I translated the first book in 1 year, the second book in second year, and the third and fourth in the third year, because we had trouble with the Czechs, which were also translating it. And you know, in Slovakia the situation is a bit difficult, because if the book is published in Czech, then the Slovaks do understand it. So it's, if it is published before, so the Slovak edition, they will buy the Czech translation. But I remember I was very grateful to Elena Ferrante that she didn't use the Neapolitan dialect, because I couldn't possibly make the Neapolitans like folks from Eastern Slovakia or something. She put there some occasional kilustruns, but that you can resolve some vulgarism or something. But that was a great thing that she didn't use it more often, because that causes me problems, because Italy has a lot of dialects, and I really have no idea how to deal with this. In Slovak, I really don't know how to do that, but that wasn't the problem. Another problem was, there is in the third book, that Lila is becoming this computer expert, and there's a lot of vocabulary about the beginnings of computer programming, and I had to consult someone about this. But apart from that, I didn't have particular problems with Elena Ferrante, because there are authors that you really just sometimes don't understand what they're up to. But Elena Ferrante is quite understandable and clear. She, you know, it's profound, but it's not, what does she want to say?
Yes, absolutely. Dialect is always a very challenging element of a literary text to translate, because on the one hand you can think about looking for parallels in this example in Slovakia, but then you can't have Italian characters displaying and exhibiting specifically and characteristically Slovak behaviors and attitudes, because that would damage the context of the text. But then on the other hand, if you translate something very marked language, it's very marked and which conveys and which communicates information about the character and their social background and their values and all these kind of inferences that a reader will make, and you translate that into something non-marked and something standard, you lose a lot of information. So it's a very challenging thing to try and reproduce and relay the information that's contained in the original without damaging the context. And there's no perfect way of doing that. You have to deal with each instance on its own merits.
I want to say also that the difference with the Czechs, they tend to naturalize everything. When you see, for example, Harry Potter in Czech and in Slovak, they're two different things, because in Czech it's, everything is translated, and in Slovak we tend to leave the things, you know, you, when there is a street, you leave via, you leave piazza, so that the things remain as they were in the original, to get the feeling of the Italian Naples.
Sure, they call that foreignizing, I think, don't they, in the literature? Yeah. It reminds me, now you mentioned Harry Potter, in Harry Potter in English, there's a lot of characters with alliterating names. I've not read the books, but I'm just aware of the situation. Because in English is a rhyme-weak language. It doesn't mm-hmm. rhyme very well. And alliteration is a device, a poetic device that authors will often exploit. Mm-hmm. But when translated into Spanish, they had to reformulate aspects of the book. So it conformed to Spanish language expectations mm-hmm. about language use. So they took the alliteration in characters' names and they turned it into rhyming character names, because Spanish is a Latinate language, like Italian, very rhyme strong. And they prefer poetry to rhyme rather than to be alliterative. So that's quite a good example, I think, of adaptation, whereas obviously sometimes adaptation kind of butchers a text. It can be quite damaging, but in a skilled hand, in a moderate way, it can be very effective. And I think that's quite a good example mm-hmm. of that. So we're getting to the end now. Thank you for your time. And before we go, what are you working on at the moment? Have you got any projects either as an author or as a translator that you're currently working on?
As a translator, I'm very fortunate because I have always work. So now I'm working on a collection by Simone de Beauvoir, which I don't know, it's Broken Woman in English, and it should be published at the beginning in spring. And then I should translate Silvia Valone. I don't know whether she was translated in English, but she's quite popular here. And in Slovakia, it was a great success. We translated one book called From Where the Life is Perfect. And now there is this book called Friendship. And then I will probably translate a new novel by Marin Diaye. And then my publisher is saying to me that maybe short stories by Valeria Parella, we will see. And as an author, I've been working on a novel for the last 2 years. That should be published this year, but I prefer, as it's not finished yet, and I'm not sure how it works out. I prefer not to talk too much about it because I'm a bit superstitious. So everyone asks me what's about. I prefer not to say because writing is something kind of magic and you shouldn't spoil it before. But I hope there will be a novel at the end of the year.
Wow, so lots to look forward to. Interesting, actually, what you just said. I did an interview with Elvira Naval, and in response to the same question, she gave a very similar answer. She said, I don't like to talk about work in progress because I feel if I talk about it, it's going to escape.
But I remember at some readings, I was like, yes, I'm writing this novel, this short story, and then nothing So it's embarrassing. If it's better to wait until it's finished.
Sure. So I won't press you for further information on that so as not to rob the book from you. Thank you so much for your time, for your readings and for your work. And we look forward to seeing more from you this year and the next. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a conversation with Slovak author and translator Ivana Dobrakovova, including a bilingual excerpt from her EUPL awarded collection of stories, Mothers and Truckers, due out in English translation by Julia and Peter Sherwood later in 2021 from Jantar Publishing. Women in Translation is an audio series showcasing the richness of European women authors, translators, and more. This series is executive produced by Trafica Europe Radio. Please sign up at our site to stay informed about upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.